This is Radio EcoShock with the returning guest, Dmitry Orlov. He's the Russian expat who analyzed collapse in the Soviet Union. As a lesson for America in its last days of empire, Dmitry, I understand you've finished a new manuscript. Can you give us some hints about that?
Well, I'm in the process of finishing it. It is basically an update to the first edition of Reinventing Collapse. Not that big an update, because most of what I said turns out to still be more or less up to date. Some of my predictions have started coming true. And also, now that peak oil is behind us, I can expand on what I said about energy in the first edition, because there are some repercussions that peak oil is starting to have that are going to become more and more obvious.
Let's talk more about that book as the publication approaches. Meanwhile, as you know, I've called to get some more insight into the experience about that massive heat wave and the fires in Russia in the summer of 2010. Would you care to give us some first impressions?
Well, I wasn't there, so what I know about it is what I was able to learn from reading Russian language press and blogs. Russians are, they use LiveJournal a great deal. That's their main blogging site. And there were a lot of interesting articles on LiveJournal from first-hand witnesses to the events. So that, for instance, whereas the government was saying that very few people really died and that the situation was more or less under control, what you learned from the blogs was that morgues were filled to capacity rather quickly, that operating theaters and hospitals that didn't have air conditioning had surgeons faint during surgery, that even appendectomies were postponed, that most people who were delivered to hospitals for resuscitation, in fact, died. So there was a bit of a jump in mortality. A lot of elderly people and people with respiratory problems and circulatory problems succumbed to this heat wave. But if you just look at the photos and the reports that came out of Moscow, the visibility was down to something like a third of a mile for a few days straight. This was really an environmental disaster.
Right, and Moscow is located at 56 degrees north. That's a similar latitude to the Alaskan Panhandle or Glasgow in Scotland. And so a warm, sunny day should be about 75 degrees there, not over 100 degrees or 38 Celsius as it was day after day. I'm wondering, there must be some psychological shock that this could happen, that the people there would feel. What do you think?
Well, I think that it takes a lot to shock Russians, more than most people. I think that there is a little bit of an understanding now that maybe the strategy of developing the Moscow region is not such a good strategy. Russia has become very, very centralized. It came under Yeltsin, it came to the point of dissolution. Various regions started going their own way. And then Yeltsin pulled it all back together, basically by concentrating authority and money and everything within Moscow region. And the result of that was very visible in the heat maps that came out during this heat wave, where there was a big red angry spot on top of the Moscow region. And you can understand that this is actually the result of all this economic development, because forests were replaced with developments, with roads, a lot of energy production, a lot of cars, all concentrated in relatively small geographic area, resulted in a place that during the summer is just not survivable anymore. Now, you're right that it's very far north, but it's also very far inland. There isn't the moderating influence of an ocean anywhere nearby. So the further you get into the center of Eurasia, which is a huge continent, the more of a continental climate you have, with very, very cold winters and very, very hot summers, brief but hot. And if this is the pattern, then this really means that Moscow region is not going to be survivable for much longer.
Well, and they also seem to have mismanaged the peat areas around Moscow, and that made the fires and the smoke even worse.
Well, I don't know what could be managed about peat bogs. They just exist. It's just that it's when it's very dry and very hot, they start smoldering. And this is something that has happened throughout the north of Russia, not just in the Moscow region, but also in the Leningrad region near around St. Petersburg. There were peat bog fires this summer and smoke.
Do you think it's fair to say that the authorities were poorly prepared for these events?
Well, there was actually, you know, the forestry director was fired by Putin as the result of all of this. And a lot of it really had to do with this equivocation in terms of who should be managing it. Because on the one hand, it must be conceded that things work a little bit better if everything is orchestrated from Moscow. On the other hand, they do try to put people, local people, in positions of authority. So there was a very confused plan where local authorities had to bid out firefighting to various private companies. Now, you can imagine that in an emergency situation, a bidding process is not exactly what you want to follow. So that was part of the problem, that, you know, the whole effort, it wasn't clear who was supposed to actually be organizing it, and the result was a bit of chaos.
Right. Well, you know, scientists around the world seem, they're still discussing about whether this Russian disaster was caused by global warming as such. The Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, said clearly that it was, and that's surprising considering the formerly cavalier attitude of the Russian government towards climate change. Putin said warming could be good for his country. Do you see a possible change in Russia's stance?
Yes, I can, because up till now, global warming was really something that Westerners talked about. And the funny thing is, you know, Westerners do talk about climate change and the need to combat climate change, but that doesn't stop them from buying Russian gas and oil and burning it, does it? So from the Russian point of view, it's just a bunch of Westerners talking out both sides of their mouth like they usually do. It doesn't really mean anything new or different or interesting. Now, what's different about the situation now is that the message has been brought to home rather forcefully. And Russians do tend to have a relationship with their land that is fairly intimate. And when they see such incredible damage occurring around them, they do tend to reflect on it. In terms of reaching consensus within the scientific community, you know, I think if we have to wait for scientific consensus before we actually decide to act or to take steps, we'll basically all die. And so I think that there's a little bit of an intuitive appreciation required in order to understand that this is something that, you know, it's happening. It's actually happening.
I couldn't agree more. You know, you bring up the scientists. It seems incredible to me that there are still Russian scientists, and not just fringe ones, who deny climate change vehemently. The most startling news stories quote scientists saying Americans are to blame for the heat wave. They think that the HAARP project in Alaska was used as a climate weapon. How could this Cold War thinking keep going in Russia against all experience and evidence?
Well, there's absolutely no accounting for what people will do or say for a bit of notoriety, and it doesn't really mean anything at all. I would say that, you know, people who pay attention to people who say things like that, you know, they bring it upon themselves. They could do just as well to completely ignore them.
I'd like to explore the Russian situation as a prelude for what we can expect in the coming decades in many parts of the world as the planet heats up. And you've looked at sort of the survival techniques that were developed as the Soviet Union fell apart. So I'm wondering, in that context, what could we learn from what happened in Russia last summer?
Well, realization that we all need to have is that as the climate is getting more and more erratic, the only thing that we can really do to protect ourselves is to live within a microclimate that is survivable. So that if you live in a very built-up place that is denuded of foliage, then you're likely to die in a heat wave. But if you live in a very leafy and heavily forested place and keep it that way, have a bit of wetland around you, have a body of water next to you, things like that, basically live closer to nature, then you will stand a chance.
Well, maybe that's why I'm in Vancouver. Now, Dmitry Orlov, in your 2008 book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, you stress the importance of the kitchen garden to the survival of the average Russian. After what we saw this summer, I'm wondering if our community gardens and home gardens will also fail as more extreme heat and drought events come to visit. Is anyone really safe from a climate going to extremes like that?
Nobody is really absolutely 100% safe, and that is actually a rather ridiculous thing to strive for. We all take our chances. But a system where all sorts of different food from different types of seed are grown by many different kind of people in many different environments, I would say is much better adapted for a disrupted climate than industrial monoculture, which does row crop growing, commercial crops, which can all fail at the same time. And you can see those types of failures. One third of the harvest, wheat harvest in Russia has failed. That will have repercussions on, you know, the couscous and the pasta eating countries around the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And a few years ago I was in Vermont and the entire corn harvest failed because it got rained out, because they all plant more or less the same variety at the same time. And so big agricultural systems like that that practice monoculture, industrial agriculture, are much more likely to suddenly fail in a catastrophic way than a system where many people are doing lots of different things. And if one thing doesn't pan out, then maybe another one will. And if the kitchen gardens don't have much of a yield, then there might be some wild foods. There's a way of planting edible species in a forested environment so that you have nuts and various other things and berries that you can fall back on. And Russians do quite a lot of that. There's a lot of berry and mushroom and nut picking that goes on.
Also in your writing, you suggested that one of the things we'll need to do if civilization is indeed shrinking or collapsing, perhaps due to oil running out and other reasons, was that we'll have to secure the nuclear materials and try and decommission as much as we can of the nuclear projects. And now we see that in Russia, one of the more sensational impacts were the fires burning around nuclear bases and even forests soaked with radiation from Chernobyl. What can you say about that?
Well, I think that basically the ground has been laid for various types of catastrophes, big and small, in the nuclear nations especially. I think that, you know, some of the nuclear reservations in the United States are just as bad and in the long run just as unmaintainable as various sites in Russia. The radiation levels I believe they rose somewhat, but I haven't really seen any conclusive numbers on that as a result of the forest fires. But this is not limited to Russia to any extent. During the heat wave a few years ago in France, the nuclear power plants that produce a lot of the electricity in France that are all built along the Loire, a lot of them had trouble getting enough cooling water from the river because the water level in the river fell so much. So this is not by any means limited to a specific country. It's just that the nuclear industry is very dangerous and requires an intact industrial infrastructure in order to keep it under control. So since the half-life of these radioactive materials is guaranteed to be longer than the life of civilization or even the lifetime of the human species in all likelihood, there will be a lot of radioactive pollution on planet Earth moving forward. That's virtually guaranteed.
Well, and also learning from events in Russia, I noticed a lot of public anger and calls for punishment of officials. The government announced some criminal charges. And meanwhile, Prime Minister Putin was shown everywhere, even helping put out a fire from a water bomber. I'm wondering, extreme climate events could fuel demands for more authoritarian government, or they could hasten the breakdown of government. What are your thoughts?
It really depends on the local political culture. In Russia, a lot of the people are very suspicious of their government, very mistrustful of their government, but they're even more afraid of weakness. So if you look at who in Russia has the most authority, it's definitely Putin. Medvedev is pretty far down the list. He's liked, I think, to some extent, but he's not particularly powerful yet. And after Putin, I would say that the mafia has a lot of influence in Russia. And after the mafia, according to the various reports I've seen on this, it's the various ministries, the various officials that run the government. So it is really it's the fallout from the weakness that Russia went through after the collapse of the Soviet Union and under Yeltsin that Russians are encouraged by having a leader who is actually not afraid to lead. For Western tastes, it definitely smacks of authoritarianism and doesn't resemble anything that they recognize as a democracy.
Well, I could see some impacts, though, on the United States as well. We saw how the Bush government failed during Katrina, which was definitely climate-related. And if we had a really extreme event in the United States, there could be demands for more authoritarian figures. I'm sort of worried about the Glenn Becks and the Sarah Palins of this world getting some kind of power as people just, well, they freak out because it's hot, and it doesn't stop.
Yes, I'm not particularly afraid of the Sarah Palins and the Glenn Becks because they're just far too incompetent. You look at these people and yes, there's some kind of AstroTurf movement that was paid for by some well-heeled individuals, and some misguided people are following them around, but it's very much staged. I mean, there's really no substance to it at all. It's portrayed as some kind of a grassroots movement, but really, it's one of those, you know, AstroTurf lobbying campaigns that's just paid for by someone.
I found this Russian situation, the heat and the fires, were kind of shocking to me. It's another milestone event like the loss of the Arctic sea ice. I'm still not sure what it means, and I don't think I'm alone in that. What have you heard from others inside and outside Russia?
Well, for the longest time, Russians didn't really pay a lot of attention to all this talk about climate. They just weren't particularly interested in it. For the first time, Russia was prosperous, still is. For the first time, Russians can travel widely, can drive cars, can buy their own houses if they want. Russia, according to what the Russians see, is becoming a normal country. And this is something that they like a lot. And there's a lot of ostentation that has lately become fashionable in Russia. So Russians like to buy SUVs and drive them around. The roads in Russia are not very good, especially if you get out of the city centers. And so having a four-wheel drive all-terrain vehicle is actually seen as a really good thing. They like basically going through this kind of dream phase like the United States went through in the 50s, where everything is big and everything is new. They're putting up big box stores. They're embracing consumerism. They have internet everywhere, even in little villages. And, you know, this is something that they really want, and this is important to them. Now, all of this Western talk about climate change, so far they've been able to ignore it pretty well, but, you know, this event this summer maybe is changing it, and the fact that Medvedev is tapping into these feelings and actually saying that, you know, this is important and we have to find a new way to work, which is what he said, that's more or less a direct quote, basically means that, you know, the government is ready to get involved in figuring out what has to be done about it. One of the easiest things for Russia to do would be to cut oil and gas exports. So they wouldn't be depriving the Russian people of energy, but they would be depriving these Westerners who've been clamoring about climate change for some time. So this would give them a chance to do something about it by burning less oil and natural gas. I don't know that that's what he will do, but it seems like a logical step.
Well, as we close out, is there something you would like to add, another dimension to this story?
We'll just have to watch and see what happens. But every summer, every year, there's a lot of new developments. It's not just Russia. It's Pakistan underwater, for instance. Every year, we'll have more and more environmental disasters. It's not just a gradual rise in temperature. It's a gradual rise in the number of extreme weather events throughout the planet. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yes, we saw Australia burn last year, and here in British Columbia, we had fires so great that the smoke went halfway across the continent. So it's an ongoing story, as you say. Our guest has been Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example, and American Prospects. Look for the revised edition coming out soon. And did you want to say anything more about that new edition that you're working on?
It'll be out next spring. It'll contain quite a bit of updated material.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Follow Dmitry Orlov at his blog, cluborlov.blogspot.com, or check out his Wikipedia entry. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. I recommend you track down his previous interviews on Radio EcoShock and read up on Dmitry's work, because you will learn more about surviving our future challenges. Thank you so much, Dmitry.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.